This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I struggled for these tablets a little bit. It wasn't even so simple. Yerushalmi says in the fourth chapter of Tainis, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman says in the name of Rabbi Yonasan, Haluchos hayu orchon vav tfochim v'rochon gimel. The luchos, the tablets, were 6 tefachim by 3 tefachim. That would be approximately 24 inches by 12 inches. That's the smallest estimate we've got of their size. Most other estimates are that they were considerably larger. And God was handing it. Look at the image. God was handing it to Moshe. And God was still holding the two tefach on the top. Moshe had already grasped the two tefach at the bottom. So at that instant, God and Moshe are touching, physically, holding. Talk about the touch. They're actually transferring a piece, an object, from one to the other. And for that brief moment, God and man are holding the same tablet. At that very instant, Osu Yisrael Osu Maase, it was at that moment that the Jews began their dance around the golden calf. Timing, sense of timing. Sometimes we don't realize, we do something in the privacy of our own lives, but we don't realize what that timing might be in other parts of the universe. Bikesh HaKadosh Baruch Hu lechotfo miyodo shel Moshe. God tried to grab the luchos back. Say, this is not for you, this is not for them, just give it back. What did Moshe do? V'gavro yodo shel Moshe, v'chotfo mimeh. Moshe applied all his strength and he grabbed them out of God's hands. That's what he did. He actually forced, he prized the luchos out of God's hands. Took them. Because of Meshabcho B'Sof. And later on, God in fact says to Moshe, Yeshakeach, congratulations that you took the luchos. God actually acknowledges that that was the right thing for him to do. And again, that just makes my question even more difficult. Moshe took it and God knew that it was going to be broken. And Moshe knew that they would have to be broken because he saw God was taking it back. He understood why he was taking it back. And yet Moshe grabs it. He wants it. He takes them even though they're going to have to be smashed. What is it? The software marketers know already, and clearly I think most of us intuitively understand, although we don't understand the logic of it. But I think most of us understand that there is a different experience going into a software store and buying software beautifully packaged in a, you know, they come in these huge boxes. It's one little disc, but they come in these big boxes. You've got to throw away a lot of material when you're finished unpacking your software. They don't put them in little envelopes. Why? Because the marketers know you want something substantial. We're still old-fashioned in that way. Probably always will be. And most of us know that there's a different quality of feeling in purchasing the software in one of those boxes and loading the CD-ROM onto your computer than to downloading it from the internet. And if it costs the same, most people would rather have the disc. But what is there in that handling and transfer of something physical? We've spoken often, and this is probably the best image of this type of transaction, about the wedding ceremony. The wedding ceremony, what is it? It's a contractual arrangement between two people blessed by God. So what should take place? The two people should come to shul or come to a chuppah, understand that. They should stand under the chuppah, understand that. There should be a document that records what's taking place. There should be a ksuba, understand that. There should be blessings, brachos, fine, understand that. Glass of wine, a l'chaim, all fine. Why a ring? Where does the ring come from? What has that got to do with the fact that two people are making an agreement? The ring is a transaction. The ring is the transfer of something physical, something material, from one party to another. And the reason is, because if you transfer anything that is non-material, it entails no loss to the transferer. If you have knowledge and you transfer that knowledge to somebody else, you haven't lost the knowledge. Communicate something to somebody else, you haven't lost the communication. You communicate an emotion, you love somebody else, you've lost their love. The only time that there is a kind of a zero-sum game, that by giving somebody else something, you left without that something, is if the thing you gave is material. And that's why we've had discussions at this year and in others of the importance of material generosity in a man-woman relationship, or for that matter, in any relationship. A relationship in which there is no material generosity, that means money passing hands by means of gifts, by means of investment, of something that costs one, there is no true relationship. When we talk about touching, when we talk about not just reaching somebody, but touching somebody, there needs to be the transfer of something that costs the one, that the one person benefits from at the cost of the other. If it's win-win, it's lose-lose. It is only win-win when it is win-lose. The only time that both parties win is if one party lost, because that's the only time there's value. If it costs nothing for nobody, then it's worth nothing for anybody. There has to be a cost. There has to be a value. And a value is only when where one person is losing that which he's giving in the belief that the giving is worth more to him than the loss. That's what a relationship means. I'm willing to take something away from myself and give it to you because I find more pleasure and worth in giving it to you than in having it myself. That's how we touch one another. But when we don't do that, when we relate to one another, and we love one another, and we wish one another a happy good day, and everything's great and wonderful with one another, but we don't invest in one another, there's reach, but there's no touch. That's the internet economy. It costs us nothing to send emails. It costs nothing. That's why people say silly things on email. Because it costs nothing. It's quick, it's easy, it's inexpensive. If you had to take out a pen and find paper and get the ink, and then look for a postage stamp and go to the post office, we wouldn't write such rubbish on the email. We wouldn't be circulating each other with these tons of garbage that come on and on and on, because it just doesn't cost no time, so why not send it? If it costs no time, it's worth nothing. If it costs no money, it's worth nothing. And a communication that has been sent that costs the sender nothing. Forward. Press. Another 50 people get the garbage. Delete. Gone. That's not touching. There can be no touch when there is no cost in that touching, when there is no investment in that touching. God didn't want the transaction at Sinai to be an internet transaction. He didn't want that to be a virtual transaction. That was not a Sinai.com. That was real life. And God took that stone, the Midrash tells us, from his carved it out of his throne. And if we would go to God's throne now, you would see a big gaping gap there. That's where he took the stone from. He took it out of his own furniture. He took it out of his own most precious place, out of his own throne. And he wrote the Torah on a physical piece of material that he took. Because to give us the Torah without the block, he would have been left without having lost anything. God gives us the Torah doesn't mean that he doesn't have the Torah anymore. He's taught the Torah with us, to us. He's shared the Torah with us. It's interesting that in the American language, the word share is very popular. Have you noticed? Please share that information with us. Would you like to share with us how you're feeling? Don't tell us. Don't give it to us. Share it with us so that it doesn't cost you anything. We're not asking you for anything. God forbid that we should ask you to lose it. Just share it with us. We like to share because there's no cost in sharing. But that's not how you touch people. We touch people when we don't share. We touch people when we give, not share. People say, share and you get close when you share. You don't get close when you share. What sharing means is, I'll give you some as long as you don't take it away from me. That's not intimacy. Intimacy is not sharing. intimacy is giving. Intimacy is not sharing the same toothbrush. Intimacy is going out and buying a beautiful toothbrush for your partner. It's more intimate than sharing the toothbrush. And God didn't want this to be an internet transaction. He wanted to carve a piece of stone out of his own seat and physically hand it to man. The only time in history that there is a physical transaction between God and man. And for that there has to be the silicon chip. There has to be something material, there has to be something real. This cannot just be the transfer of digital data. This has to be the transfer of something that is limited, something that is precious and dear, something that God can take from his own resources and lose in his desire to give it to the children of Israel. Now at the opening, what was on these tablets of stone? What did it say? First sentence, just prior to the, but it forms part of the Ten Commandments, verse 1 of chapter 20. Vayedaber Elokim eskol ha'dvarim ha'ele lemor. And God spoke all of these things, say. They were all spoken by God. He didn't only give it to us. It wasn't just in the written form. He didn't just send an email. He didn't just write it on the silicon chip and hand it to us. He also said it. And it was in fact his saying of it that constituted the engraving. As he said it, he engraved it in the stone. And this that he said, all of these things, that God said them all, b'dibur echad. God said it all simultaneously. So it doesn't say God said these words. And God said all of these things, le'mor, in a saying. Again, difficult to understand. If it were communicated to us only mechanically by means of ordinary sound waves, we would not have been able to hear God say it all simultaneously. But if God sends it, how does an email go? You press your send button, how long does it take for a 10-page letter to get there? It's instant. The last word of the 10-page letter gets there at the same time as the first word. Because when you're communicating electrically, there is no time lag, there is no noticeable time lag, no significant time lag. And so the communication from God to man was instant, and all of it was instant. It all was communicated in one shot. Of course, as we heard it, as it unraveled in our ears, as we translated it into regular sound, it had a sequence to it. And we will find, in fact, certain parts where God said two different things at the same time. And again, people struggle, even the Rishonim struggle to understand, what does that mean? The very commandments of Shabbat, which we're going to learn about. Here we're told, those of you who have the Chumash will see it, in verse 7. Zachor es yom ha-Shabbos l'kadsho. Remember the day of the Shabbos to sanctify it. The same Ten Commandments repeated in Devarim, the word is not Zachor, the word is Shamor. And we say in the Lecha Yehudi every Friday night, Zachor v'Shamor b'dibur echad. God said both, Zachor and Shamor. He said both remember and observe b'dibur echad simultaneously. How could we have heard that? How could God have said that? How can you communicate two different words simultaneously when it's coming from one mouth? Well, you could send two different emails that say two different things, and you can send them simultaneously. When you're communicating electrically, you can communicate different and even conflicting things simultaneously. When we unravel it, we've got to unravel it sequentially. But all of these are indications that the process of communication was an electrical process of communication. It was not a mechanical process of communication. And the entire Ten Commandments, the Chizkuni said, was in one statement, in one phrase. There wasn't a sequence, there wasn't a time lag between the beginning and the end. And we start with the first of the commandments, which we'll make a beginning of, and then get into it in some detail next week. The first of the commandments is Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hutzeisicho Meretz Mitzrayim Mibeis Avadim. I am the Lord your God, who has taken you out of the land of Egypt, land of slavery. Lo yihye lecho elokim achirim al ponoi. That actually begins, although it's in the middle of the sentence, that according to most authorities begins the second commandment. So the first commandment ends at the middle of the sentence. I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt to the land of the house of slavery. That's the first commandment. Which is not really a commandment at all, it's a statement of fact. But interestingly, they're all statements of fact. Certainly all the negative commandments on the second set, because when it says thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, it doesn't actually say thou shalt not. Thou shalt not would have been al tirtach. Al tirtach means thou shalt not murder. Al tignov would mean thou shalt not steal. Lo tignov and lo tirtach means you will not steal, you will not murder. It's a statement of fact. And links back to the first statement of fact, and that's why we don't call them Ten Commandments. We call them Ten Sayings, Ten Statements. They're not Asorah Mitzvahs. It's not the Ten Commandments, the Ten Mitzvahs. It's Asorah Dibros. These are four statements of fact. These are ten statements of fact. The first statement is, I am the Lord your God. And if you really knew that, you will not murder. You will not steal. Not you shall not, you will not. If you really knew the first statement of fact clearly, the rest would be automatic. When we do those things we shouldn't do, it's because we don't fully grasp the meaning of the first one. We don't really have clarity as to the existence of God, because if we did, we wouldn't do it. Now this first commandment, this first statement, is there a mitzvah involved in that? Is there a commandment? And if so, what is it? Nearly all authorities agree that there is a mitzvah here. The Ramban says the mitzvah is... Well, let me show you first what the Ramban says. The Ramban has a work which he calls the Book of Mitzvahs, in which he enumerates and briefly cites each of the 613 mitzvahs. And that's quite important because there isn't consensus on exactly which are the 613 mitzvahs. All we know for sure is that there are 613. And some of these, the majority of them, of course, there is consensus about. Everybody knows that a mitzvah that's stated quite clearly, that's quite clear. But if you actually count every mitzvah in the Torah, depending on how you count, there are either more than 613 or less than 613. So the Rishonim go through, and the Gaonim before them, there was a period in Jewish learning which was quite interesting, where they worked out the mathematics of calculating what constitutes a mitzvah by figuring out which are the 613. So the Rambam wrote his work, the Book of Mitzvahs, the first part, he works the mathematics. What are the criteria for determining whether a statement is a mitzvah or it isn't? Then using those criteria, and altogether he has 13 criteria, I think, using those 13 criteria, he then goes through the Torah, applies every statement of the Torah to the 13 criteria and finds 613 mitzvot and lists which are the 613 according to those criteria. The Ramban has slightly different criteria. Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon has slightly different criteria, and so a number of others, slightly different criteria, which result in a slightly different listing of the 613 mitzvot. And the Rambam lists as the first mitzvah, HaMitzvah Rishonah, the very first mitzvah is HaTzivui Asher Tzivonu, is the commandment which God instructed us. So the Rambam learns that although these are Diburim, although these are statements, they are statements that contain compelling mitzvahs. The first mitzvah is LaHa'amin HaElokus, to believe in godliness, to believe in the idea of a God. But who? Let's define that. What does that mean exactly? Shena'amin, we must believe, Shiyesh Shem, Olav V'Sibo, that there is a name, a something, a power, a force, which is the cause, and Po'el L'chol HaNimtzos, the one who initiated all of existence. That's the first mitzvah. Where do we know from? V'hu Amor Yisbor, that comes from the mitzvah we've just learnt. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. That's what it means. I am the Lord your God simply means there is a force that exists and that initiated all of existence. That's God. Now, the Rambam also wrote his main work, which is his work that covers in detail all the laws, including the rabbinic laws, everything, every law that comes from the Gemara. So the Sefer HaMitzvahs, this work is a list of all the mitzvahs in the Torah, in the five books of Moses, the 613 mitzvahs. The Yad HaChazaka, of which this is just one volume, and this is a miniature volume, is a listing of every mitzvah that appears in the Gemara, in the entire Talmud. That goes through all the instructions and laws that are developed in the Talmud using the methodology that God taught Moses to extract and extrapolate thousands and thousands of laws from those 613. And in this work, the Rambam starts it off also right in the very beginning with slightly different language. And he says, Yesod ha-yesodos ve-omud ha-chochmos, is how he opens this work. And it's interesting, if you look at those first four words, Yesod ha-sodos ve-omud ha-chochmos, if you look at the first letter of each of those words, which was sometimes the style of writing at that time, the Yud, Yesod, ha-yesodos is hey, ve-omud is another vav, ha-chochma, of wisdom, there, but another hey, so it's Yud Kei Vav Kei, God's name. And he starts off, the foundation of all foundations and the pillar of all wisdom is laid out to know. Here he doesn't say to believe, he says to know. Sheyesh Shem Motzu Rishon, that there is a first force, the Hu Mantzi Kol Nimtza, that created, that gave birth to, that gave rise to all of existence. So he uses the word know, and he uses the word believe, and the Ramban on the Chumash on this first commandment says, Yoreh v'yetzaveh, Hashem teaches and instructs. Sheyedu v'yaminu, he uses both words, that they should know and believe. Ki yesh Hashem v'hu Elokim lohem, that there is a God and he is their God. Personalizes it. And I just want to briefly discuss why know and believe. If you know something, do you need to believe it? Perhaps the other way around would have been a little bit more sensible. You need to believe and know. Not only believe, but you should even know it. But the Rambam twists it around. The Rambam says you need to know it, but not only know it, you need to believe it. Which seems to imply that belief gives more certainty than knowledge, which in our information-driven era is not something that is easily understood. We say belief, well, that's subjective, that's your perception. Knowledge, that's what it's all about, facts. Do the people who smoke cigarettes know the facts about its impact on health? Yes. Do they believe it? No. If they really believed it, they wouldn't smoke. Belief takes knowledge and personalizes it into action. And so the Ramban says what God is saying here is not only know. It's easy to know that there's a God. You don't have to be so wise to know that there's a God, because it's almost impossible, not almost, it is impossible to make sense of the world without God. It's hard enough with God in the picture. But without God in the picture, it's totally absurd. So you don't have to be a big chochem, believe it or not, to figure out that there's a God. You can know it. Oh, but to believe it, that's much harder. And the first of the Ten Commandments is not just know that there's a God, but believe that there's a God. And the outcome of that belief will be what we'll be discussing as we go through the series in future weeks on the Ten Commandments. Thank you. The software marketers know already, and clearly I think most of us intuitively understand, although we don't understand the logic of it, but I think most of us understand that there is a different experience in going into a software store and buying software beautifully packaged in a, you know, they come in these huge boxes. It's one little disc, but they come in these big boxes. You've got to throw away a lot of material when you're finished unpacking your software. They don't put them in little envelopes. Why? Because the marketers know you want something substantial. We're still old-fashioned in that way, probably always will be. And most of us know that there's a different quality of feeling in purchasing the software in one of those boxes and loading the CD-ROM onto your computer than to downloading it from the internet. And if it costs the same, most people would rather have the disc. It's What is there in that handling and transfer of something physical? We've spoken often, and this is probably the best image of, this type of transaction, about the wedding ceremony. The wedding ceremony, what is it? It's a contractual arrangement between two people blessed by God. So what should take place? The two people should come to shul or come to a chuppah, understand that. They should stand under the chuppah, understand that. There should be a document that records what's taking place. There should be a ksuba, understand that. There should be blessings, brokers, fine, understand that. Glass of wine, a l'chaim, all fine. Why a ring? Where does the ring come from? What has that got to do with the fact that two people are making an agreement? The ring is a transaction. The ring is the transfer of something physical, something material, from one party to another. And the reason is because if you transfer anything that is non-material, it entails no loss to the transferer. If you have knowledge and you transfer that knowledge to somebody else, you haven't lost the knowledge. Communicate something to somebody else, you haven't lost the communication. You communicate an emotion, you love somebody else, you've lost their love. The only time that there is a kind of a zero-sum game, that by giving somebody else something, you left without that something, is if the thing you gave is material. And that's why we've had discussions at this year and in others of the importance of material generosity in a man-woman relationship, or for that matter, in any relationship. A relationship in which there is no material generosity, that means money passing hands by means of gifts, by means of investment, of something that costs one, there is no true relationship. When we talk about touching, when we talk about not just reaching somebody, but touching somebody, there needs to be the transfer of something that costs the one, that the one person benefits from at the cost of the other. If it's win-win, it's lose-lose. It is only win-win when it is win-lose. The only time that both parties win is if one party lost, because that's the only time there's value. If it costs nothing for nobody, then it's worth nothing for anybody. There has to be a cost. There has to be a value. And a value is only when where one person is losing that which he's giving, in the belief that the giving is worth more to him than the loss. That's what a relationship means. I'm willing to take something away from myself and give it to you, because I find more pleasure and worth in giving it to you than in having it myself. That's how we touch one another. But when we don't do that, when we relate to one another, and we love one another, and we wish one another a happy good day, and everything's great and wonderful with one another, but we don't invest in one another, there's reach, but there's no touch. That's the internet economy. Costs us nothing to send emails. Costs nothing. That's why people say silly things on email. Because it costs nothing. It's quick, it's easy, it's inexpensive. If you had to take out a pen and find paper and get the ink, and then look for a postage stamp and go to the post office, we wouldn't write such rubbish on the email. We wouldn't be circulating each other with these tons of garbage that come on and on and on, because it just doesn't cost no time, so why not send it? If it costs no time, it's worth nothing. If it costs no money, it's worth nothing. And a communication that has been sent that costs the sender nothing. Forward. Press. Another 50 people get the garbage. Delete. Gone. That's not touching. There can be no touch when there is no cost in that touching, when there is no investment in that touching. God didn't want the transaction at Sinai to be an internet transaction. He didn't want that to be a virtual transaction. That was not a Sinai.com. That was real life. And God took that stone, the Midrash tells us, from his carved it out of his throne. And if we would go to God's throne now, you would see a big gaping gap there. That's where he took the stone from. He took it out of his own furniture. He took it out of his own most precious place, out of his own throne. And he wrote the Torah on a physical piece of material that he took, because to give us the Torah without the block he would have been left without having lost anything. God gives us the Torah, doesn't mean that he doesn't have the Torah anymore. He's taught the Torah with us, to us. He's shared the Torah with us. It's interesting that in the American language, the word share is very popular. Have you noticed? Please share that information with us. Would you like to share with us how you're feeling? Don't tell us. Don't give it to us. Share it with us so that it doesn't cost you anything. We're not asking you for anything. God forbid that we should ask you to lose it. Just share it with us. We like to share because there's no cost in sharing. But that's not how you touch people. We touch people when we don't share. We touch people when we give, not share. People say, share and you get close when you share. You don't get close when you share. What sharing means is, I'll give you some as long as you don't take it away from me. That's not intimacy. Intimacy is not sharing. Intimacy is giving. Intimacy is not sharing the same toothbrush. Intimacy is going out and buying a beautiful toothbrush for your partner. It's more intimate than sharing the toothbrush. And God didn't want this to be an internet transaction. He wanted to carve a piece of stone out of his own seat and physically hand it to man. The only time in history that there is a physical transaction between God and man. And for that there has to be the Surikun chip. There has to be something material, there has to be something real. This cannot just be the transfer of digital data. This has to be the transfer of something that is limited, something that is precious and dear, something that God can take from his own resources and lose in his desire to give it to the children of Israel. Now at the opening, what was on these tablets of stone? What did it say? First sentence, just prior to the, but it forms part of the Ten Commandments, is verse 1 of chapter 20. Vayedaber Elokim eskol ha'dvarim ha'ele lemar. And God spoke all of these things, saying. They were all spoken by God. He didn't only give it to us. It wasn't just in the written form. He didn't just send an email. He didn't just write it on the silicon chip and hand it to us. He also said it. And it was in fact his saying of it that constituted the engraving. As he said it, he engraved it in the stone. And this that he said, all of these things, that God said them all, b'dibur echad. God said it all simultaneously. So it doesn't say God said these words. And God said all of these things, lemor, in a say. Okay, difficult to understand. If it were communicated to us only mechanically by means of ordinary sound waves, we would not have been able to hear God say it all simultaneously. But if God sends it, how does an email go? You press your send button. How long does it take for a 10-page letter to get there? It's instant. The last word of the 10-page letter gets there at the same time as the first word. Because when you're communicating electrically, there is no time lag. There is no noticeable time lag, no significant time lag. And so the communication from God to man was instant, and all of it was instant. It all was communicated in one shot. Of course, as we heard it, as it unraveled in our ears, as we translated it into regular sound, it had a sequence to it. And we will find, in fact, certain parts where God said two different things at the same time. And again, people struggle, even the Rishonim struggle to understand, what does that mean? The very commandments of Shabbat, which we're going to learn about. Here we're told, those of you who have the Chumash will see it, in verse 7. Zachor es yom ha-Shabbos l'kadsho, remember the day of the Shabbos to sanctify it. The same Ten Commandments repeated in Devarim, the word is not Zachor, the word is Shamor. And we say in the Lechaludi every Friday night, Zachor v'Shamor b'dibur echad. God said both, Zachor and Shamor. He said both remember and observe b'dibur echad simultaneously. How could we have heard that? How could God have said that? How can you communicate two different words simultaneously when it's coming from one mouth? Well, you could send two different emails that say two different things, and you can send them simultaneously. when you're working, when you're communicating electrically, you can communicate different and even conflicting things simultaneously. When we unravel it, we've got to unravel it sequentially. But all of these are indications that the process of communication was an electrical process of communication, it was not a mechanical process of communication. And the entire Ten Commandments, the Chizkuni said, was in one statement, in one phrase. There wasn't a sequence, there wasn't a time lag between the beginning and the end. And we start with the first of the commandments, which we'll make a beginning of, and then get into it in some detail next week. The first of the commandments is Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Hutzeisicho Meretz Mitzrayim Mibeis Avadim. I am the Lord your God, who has taken you out of the land of Egypt, land of slavery. Lo yihyeh lecho elokim achirim al ponoi. That actually begins alert in the middle of the sentence. That, according to most authorities, begins the second commandment. So the first commandment ends at the middle of the sentence. I am the Lord your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt to the house of slavery. That's the first commandment. Which is not really a commandment at all. It's a statement of fact. But interestingly, they're all statements of fact. Certainly all the negative commandments on the second set. Because when it says, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, it doesn't actually say thou shalt not. Thou shalt not would have been al-tirtzach. Al-tirtzach means thou shalt not murder. Al-tignov would mean thou shalt not steal. Lo-tignov and lo-tirtzach means you will not steal, you will not murder. It's a statement of fact. And links back to the first statement of fact, and that's why we don't call them Ten Commandments. We call them Ten Sayings, Ten Statements. They're not Asara Mitzvahs. It's not the Ten Commandments, the Ten Mitzvahs. It's Asara Dibros. These are four statements of fact. These are ten statements of fact. The first statement is, I am the Lord your God. And if you really knew that, you will not murder. You will not steal. Not you shall not, you will not. If you really knew the first statement of fact clearly, the rest would be automatic. When we do those things we shouldn't do, it's because we don't fully grasp the meaning of the first one. We don't really have clarity as to the existence of God, because if we did, we wouldn't do it. Now this first commandment, this first statement, is there a mitzvah involved in that? Is there a commandment, and if so, what is it? Nearly all authorities agree that there is a mitzvah here. The Ramban says the mitzvah is... Well, let me show you first what the Ramban says. The Rambam has a work which he calls the Book of Mitzvahs, in which he enumerates and briefly cites each of the 613 mitzvahs. And that's quite important, because there isn't consensus on exactly which are the 613 mitzvahs. All we know for sure is that there are 613. And some of these, the majority of them, of course, there is consensus about. Everybody knows that a mitzvah that's stated quite clearly, that's quite clear. But if you actually count every mitzvah in the Torah, depending on how you count, there are either more than 613 or less than 613. So the Rishonim go through, and the Gaonim before them, there was a period in Jewish learning which was quite interesting, where they worked out the mathematics of calculating what constitutes a mitzvah by figuring out which are the 613. So the Rambam wrote his work, the Book of Mitzvahs, the first part. He works the mathematics. What are the criteria for determining whether a statement is a mitzvah or it isn't? Then using those criteria, and altogether he has 13 criteria, I think. Altogether he has 13 criteria. Using those 13 criteria, he then goes through the Torah, applies every statement of the Torah to the 13 criteria, and finds 613 mitzvah. And lists which are the 613 according to those criteria. The Ramban has slightly different criteria. Rabbein the Sadia Gaon has slightly different criteria, and so a number of others, slightly different criteria, which result in a slightly different listing of the 613 mitzvot. And the Rambam lists as the first mitzvah, HaMitzvah Rishonah, the very first mitzvah is, HaTzivui Asher Tzivonu, is the commandment which God instructed us. So the Rambam learns that although these are diburim, although these are statements, they are statements that contain compelling mitzvahs. The first mitzvah is Laha'amin Ha'elokus, to believe in godliness, to believe in the idea of a God. But who? Let's define that. What does that mean exactly? Shina'amin, we must believe, shiyesh shem, Allah v'sibor, that there is a name, a something, a power, a force, which is the cause, and po'el l'chol hanimtzos, the one who initiated all of existence. That's the first mitzvah. Where do we know from? V'hu amoy yizborach, that comes from the mitzvah we've just learnt. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. That's what it means. I am the Lord your God simply means there is a force that exists and that initiated all of existence. That's God. Now the Rambam also wrote his main work, which is his work that covers in detail all the laws, including the rabbinic laws, everything, every law that comes from the Gemara. So the Sefer HaMitzvos, this work is a list of all the mitzvahs in the Torah, in the five books of Moses, the 613 mitzvahs. The Yad HaChazaka, of which this is just one volume, and this is a miniature volume, is a listing of every mitzvah that appears in the Gemara, in the entire Talmud. That goes through all the instructions and laws that are developed in the Talmud using the methodology that God taught Moses to extract and extrapolate thousands and thousands of laws from those 613. And in this work, the Rambam starts it off also right in the very beginning with slightly different language. And he says, Yesod ha-yesodos ve-omud ha-chochmos, is how he opens this work. And it's interesting, if you look at those first four words, Yesod ha-sodos ve-omud ha-chochmos, if you look at the first letter of each of those words, which was sometimes the style of writing at that time, the Yud, Yesod, Hayesodos is Hey, the Omud is another Vav, Hachokma of wisdom, we've got another Hey, so it's Yud Kei Vav Kei, God's name. And he starts off, the foundation of all foundations and the pillar of all wisdom is Leida to know. Here he doesn't say to believe, he says to know. Sheyesh Shem Metzu Rishon, that there is a first force, the Hu Mansi Kol Nimtza, that created, that gave birth to, that gave rise to all of existence. So he uses the word know, and he uses the word believe. And the Ramban on the Chumash on this first commandment says, Yoreh V'Yetzaveh, Hashem teaches and instructs. Sheyedu V'Yaminu, he uses both words, that they should know and believe. Yesh Hashem v'hu Elokim l'hem, that there is a God and he is their God. Personalizes it. And I just want to briefly discuss why know and believe. If you know something, do you need to believe it? Perhaps the other way around would have been a little bit more sensible. You need to believe and know. Not only believe, but you should even know it. But the Rambam twists it around. The Rambam says you need to know it, but not only know it, you need to believe it. Which seems to imply that belief gives more certainty than knowledge, which in our information driven era is not something that is easily understood. We say belief, well that's subjective, that's your perception. Knowledge, that's what it's all about, facts. Do the people who smoke cigarettes know the facts about its impact on health? Yes. Do they believe it? No. If they really believed it, they wouldn't smoke. Belief takes knowledge and personalizes it into action. And so the Ramban says what God is saying here is not only know. It's easy to know that there's a God. You don't have to be so wise to know that there's a God, because it's almost impossible, not almost, it is impossible to make sense of the world without God. Hard enough with God in the picture. But without God in the picture, it's totally absurd. So you don't have to be a big chochem, believe it or not, to figure out that there's a God. You can know it. Oh, but to believe it, that's much harder. And the first of the Ten Commandments is not just know that there's a God, but believe that there's a God. And the outcome of that belief will be what we'll be discussing as we go through the series in future weeks on the Ten Commandments. Thank you.